захват власти в Калининграде и тайные переговоры оппозиции. Усиленным просьбам «Анатомия протеста 2».
Расскажите, что меня пытали.
Сколько есть?
The case against left-front leader Sergei Udaltsov and two of his associates took a sinister turn this week with reports of a brazen abduction in Kiev. Leonid Razvozhayev, an aide to opposition State Duma deputy Ilya Ponomarev, says he was abducted in the Ukrainian capital where he was seeking political asylum, and that he was taken across the border to Russia and tortured. Razvozhayev, who is still in custody, told rights workers that he was held for 2 days in a basement and forced to sign a confession claiming that he, Udaltsov, and a third man, Konstantin Lebedev, conspired with Georgian officials to provoke mass unrest in Russia. He was later taken into custody by the investigative committee in Moscow. The investigative committee, for its part, claims that Razvozhayev voluntarily surrendered to Russian authorities and confessed of his own free will. Udaltsov himself, meanwhile, was formally charged in the case today. The case began with a documentary film on the Kremlin-friendly NTV television station alleging that Udaltsov, Razvozhayev, and Lebedev met in Minsk with Georgian officials who paid them to start an uprising in Russia. Razvozhayev's alleged abduction has sparked widespread condemnation, with the UN High Commission for Refugees, the United States, and various human rights groups calling for an investigation. The Kremlin appears to have escalated its war with the opposition to a new level. But have they gone too far? Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFARL. My regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, is away on his annual excursion to Siberia. And Kirill, if you're listening, you'd better bring back some cool stories for us. On the line from New York City to fill in for Kirill this week is a familiar voice to our listeners. Mark Galeotti is a professor at New York University, an expert on the Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Good to be here.
Mark, even by the standards of today's Russia, this is pretty shocking what happened to Razvozhayev. He fled to Ukraine after being interrogated in the Udaltsov case. He was allegedly abducted outside the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society in Kiev, which is helping him with his asylum request. He was referred there by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. He says he was bundled into a van, basically hogtied. He was handcuffed and his legs were chained to his arms, had a balaclava put over his head, and driven for 5 hours across the Russian border. His abductors then turned him over to men who held him in a basement and kept him there for days in chains. He was told his family would be killed if he didn't sign a confession implicating himself, Udaltsov, and Lebedev. Mark, how much of an escalation is this, and can this turn into one of those tipping points that turns a critical mass of the public opinion against the regime?
Well, I mean, it certainly is reminiscent of the very worst of the rendition stories. But at least we're there, I mean, without in any way wanting to sort of sanction it, they were suspected terrorists that the CIA was dragging off to black sites. In this case, we have a member of the political opposition. Do I think this is an escalation? Absolutely. I'm not necessarily convinced that it's going to lead to some kind of a tipping point within Russia, though. It remains to be seen whether it becomes a cause célèbre. I think that the authorities have calculated properly that seizing a not too prominent member of the relatively ultra-left element within the opposition is a little bit safer. The point is, I don't think this case in itself is going to change anything. What does matter is precisely that it reflects a general escalation, and that is what might well be the tipping point. Not any one individual case, but if the authorities continue to mount so many different attacks on so many different fronts, and particularly in such a clumsy way. Again, I think it's maybe something we could come back to. It's interesting that it's being done in such a crude and brutal way. That might be part of the tools that they're planning on using, but also is a very dangerous approach to take.
Well, yeah, it was something I had a conversation with a colleague today about this, and he says, how do they think this wasn't going to get out? And it's almost as if they're using Soviet-era methods in a postmodern era, and that the two just are like oil and water. They don't really mix. Do you think they care? I mean, does this matter that it gets out? Maybe is that the point? I mean, this could have the effect of scaring people away from dissent. Mm-hmm. Maybe they did want the horrors of this to get out, or maybe it'll have the opposite effect and lead to that tipping point that you seem skeptical about.
Well, let me put it this way. It could be that we shouldn't be overestimating the intellect of the people concerned. that these are essentially, you know,
this is Bastrykin, after all.
Yeah, quite. You know, thuggish secret policemen using thuggish secret police methods shouldn't surprise us on one level. But at the same time, you know, these are not necessarily all knuckle-dragging, slope-four-headed individuals. And I think that, yeah, in the age of camera phones, in the age of the internet and Twitter and so forth, there must have been an awareness that something about this would get out, if not necessarily the full detail. And I think that is indeed the point. You know, you talk about Soviet-era methods and post-Soviet society.
Postmodern
necessarily
society.
Going together. Sorry. Well, postmodern, post-Soviet, post-thingy. in some ways, though, the aim is precisely to use the methods of the modern society. Because what that means is that everyone knows that you do bad, bad things. And they know it very, very quickly. And they know it through their own networks rather than through government networks. There is still, I think, on the part of, we've got to be honest, it's a part of the security apparatus, a part of the elite. You know, this is not a coherent strategy that everyone has signed up for. But certainly within the investigative committee and its allies and circles, there is still a sense that we can use shock and awe, that we can use a few very high profile, very specific and frankly very blunt cases to intimidate the rest. I think it's a foolish calculation myself. But I do think that there is some kind of rationale behind it. It's not just simply they thought, surely no one will know if we do these various things.
So you think your sense is that they knew this would get out and they wanted it to get out. The they being those that were behind this, not the entire elite, of course.
Yeah, at the very least they expected and were willing to live with that. Because let's face it, I mean, unless they're really going to try and push this all the way up to the line and try and claim that Udaltsov was involved in sort of all these kind of nefarious and frankly hard-to-believe shenanigans, I mean, Razvozhayev himself is not important. That's not in any way to demean him, but let's be honest.
He was a bit player in this whole thing until now.
Yeah, exactly. Why do you hit bit players? You do it for two reasons. One is to damage the people that they support, in this case, Udaltsov. And two is as examples. And I think that's very much the case. It's not that he counts, it's that the whole case of Razvozhayev counts.
Now, do you think Bastrykin, you mentioned that this is part of the investigative committee, part of the Siloviki, part of the elite. Was how high do you think this was sanctioned? I mean, Bastrykin's not going to pull something like this, seizing somebody on foreign soil, and regardless of what anybody in Russia may think, Ukraine is in fact foreign soil. Or was Bastrykin going rogue here? I mean, how high does this get sanctioned, do you think?
I would say this has to be sanctioned at the very top.
By Putin himself.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think particularly, I've always been skeptical of the notion that Bastrykin operated fully rogue. I mean, I think he had his own agenda and he's arguing it and pushing for it. And precisely because I think at the moment Putin hasn't got any kind of real strategy as to how to deal with the opposition, he's willing to give Bastrykin his head. However, as soon as you get to the point of actually having to operate outside of Russia, something that clearly will have needed the cooperation of the Ukrainian authorities, and that in and of itself is an interesting geopolitical insight into what's going on there. But I think as soon as it comes to that point, it's something that has to be signed off. And it also means that things like, for example, the foreign ministry would have had to have been at least, the very least aware of it. And if they were going to make a fuss about it, they would have made a fuss about it.
Do you think, I mean, this is something I've been actually wondering myself about, how much the Ukrainian authorities were down with this, because it's not really entirely clear at this point. The Ukrainian Human Rights Ombudsman was allegedly with Razvozhayev when he was meeting with this NGO, and it's nobody in the Ukrainian elite spoken out on this, and it would be relatively easy for Russia to pull something like this off without the knowledge of the Ukrainian authorities until it was too late. And what are the Ukrainians going to do about it at the end of the day, right? They're very dependent on Russia for their energy and other things. So do you think, do you take it as a given that the Ukrainian authorities were aware of this?
Well, I think when we put it into the, also the context of, if you remember, this quite dubious allegation of an assassination plot by Chechens against Putin, mm-hmm. That came up just before the elections. And again, there the Ukrainian authorities seem to have had no problem in cooperating with what was sort of a more of a political gambit than a counterterrorism operation, which suggests that actually it's not just simply that rogue elements within Ukraine, particularly the SBU, the Ukrainian political police apparatus, are happy to cooperate in informal renditions. It implies that Kiev is either perfectly comfortable with what's going on, or probably more likely accepts that it's part of the price for this current rapprochement with Russia and, you know, keeping the hydrocarbons flowing. So again, I mean, I think that whether it's that Kiev is happy or whether Kiev is acquiescent, I don't believe that there's any case that actually Kiev is just simply being caught unawares by this. There would have had to have been some kind of response.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I want to switch to one of our, along these same lines, one of our favorite subjects, and that's Bystrykin, because again, for whatever reason, whether this was intentional or not, he's got another scandal on his hands. And as I wrote on the blog yesterday, you know, hauling a journalist out to the forest and threatening his life looks positively quaint when compared to what's just happened here. And I want to pair that with another thing. The clip we heard at the very beginning was a mashup of both the Anatomy of Protest NTVID documentary that first aired these allegations, and also at the very end of that, you had the clip of Razvozhayev saying they tortured me for 2 days. Mm-hmm. That clip, incidentally enough, appeared on Life News. Now, Life News, as I'm sure you and many of our listeners know, is connected to the security services. It's no secret that they get. But this is where the torture allegations first came out. Now, the first thing I want to talk about here is that it was this could be one of two things. It could be what you were saying earlier. They wanted this to get out to scare people, or it could be something else entirely. It could be somebody trying to somebody within the security services trying to embarrass Bystrykin. Which of those things do you think is more likely, or maybe both?
Yeah, exactly. I'm very happy to have my cake and eat it. And we obviously have to thank Bystrykin, because otherwise what else would we ever have to talk about? Because he does sort of throw in these wonderful sort of situations. I mean, yes, Life News has had a long-term connection with the FSB, the Federal Security Service, which is ironically, on the one hand, aligned with Bystrykin in trying to maintain the status quo, and on the other, increasingly alarmed, suspicious, and hostile towards him, and in fact sort of seems to be adopting a rather different strategy, or wants to adopt a rather different strategy to deal with the opposition. So although I don't believe that the investigative committee didn't expect news of Razvozhayev's abduction not to get out, I'm not necessarily convinced that the details they anticipated coming out, particularly the torture allegations. It's one thing to grab someone. It's one thing to then have them sign a confession to all kinds of heinous acts. I don't think they're quite so Stalinist as to want people to think, oh my gosh, they could be torturing me too in a cellar somewhere. So yeah, I would suspect that actually that particular detail came out because the FSB wanted it to. Mm. We've seen that in the past, that the FSB is happy to embarrass Bystrykin. I mean, the classic case in point was the sort of the walk in the woods case, mm-hmm. where sort of footage mysteriously became available to the media. And it's part of the internal wranglings. And again, you know, so long as Putin either by design is happy to let the authorities claw at each other, because every now and then he likes to have these struggles to sort of keep the Siloviki in line, or whether, as I would suspect, it's more that he just doesn't have a particular strategy so that the individual agencies are much freer to do their own thing. You know, part of the way that they fight is by embarrassing their rivals.
And one of the things that suggested to me that the investigative committee didn't want this out is that the investigative committee's initial statement on this was that Razvozhayev, of his own free will, I guess, had a fit of conscience and turned himself in and signed this confession all on his own. That was the original story. Mm-hmm. Now, that story lasted exactly like a couple hours before the Life News video hit the intertubes. But and then it just escalated from there with the reports in Gazeta Rue citing witnesses in Kiev who said they saw him being abducted. You had the statement come from the United Nations Commission, High Commissioner of Refugees about expressing concern and saying that they were indeed processing, about going to process help him process his request for asylum. So it suggests to me that Bastrykhin didn't want this out or the deals, but somebody certainly did. And you would agree that this does show that there's some fighting going on the Siloviki right now around this case.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we also have to be aware of the limitations of the Investigations Committee. I'm sure there are many, many very highly technically skilled investigators, but their ability at new spin management has been demonstrated as being pretty poor. I don't think that the Investigation Committee necessarily thought that they could maintain the story forever. Again, I think we're talking about degree. If there's any realism within their media story management people, they knew that essentially the story would get out, that he had been snatched. That was going to happen. But exactly, it's the speed and the detail which is the telling point. It's one thing to say, good Lord, this man has disappeared in Ukraine. It's quite another to actually have footage of him saying, tell everyone I was tortured. And that's where the really embarrassing sort of thing comes up. Yeah.
Right. Now, going back to this case in general, the Udaltsov case, and I've been speculating a lot about this, thinking a lot about it, and trying to figure out just what this case represents. And it ranges everywhere from a modern version of the old Leningradskoye Dela, where they basically took out the intellectual elite of Leningrad in the Stalin period, to that they might want to take Udaltsov off the streets because they're fearing possible social unrest with the pension reform and all the social reforms that are coming up now. He could become a key player in the protest movement. His profile has only been rising over the last year. What do you think there, as you point out, they just might be just setting an example here and trying to scare people. Why Udaltsov, or does it matter that it's Udaltsov? It could have been anybody.
I think it does matter that it's Udaltsov, and it's quite interesting that they've sort of moved away from the Ksenia Sobchak end of the spectrum into someone like Udaltsov. And clearly this is a sort of a fairly detailed plan to address the Udaltsov problem, let's say, because you've got things like the Entebbe there documentary, which obviously doesn't just get sort of created from nowhere, which you discussed last week. Likewise, now this case, snatching someone from abroad isn't just something that you do just on the spur of the moment. So I think the question becomes, why Udaltsov? And I think the answer is, at the one point, because he's more vulnerable, and the one point, he's more dangerous. From their point of view, it will be interesting to see, but I think they probably reckon that the West is going to be much, much less eager to jump up and down and complain about the terrible treatment of an ultra-leftist than they would about, say, a Navalny.
Mm-hmm.
Navalny is much more of a well-known figure in the West as
Yale
well
educated.
As than in Russia. Oh, well, absolutely. That makes all the difference. If only he was Oxbridge, then he'd be untouchable. But the thing is that, so on the one hand, I think that sort of if you want to basically intimidate the opposition movement as a whole, and you want to pick someone relatively high profile, Udaltsov is safer than, say, Gudkov, let alone Navalny. So he's a good example to use pour encourager or décourager les autres. But on the other hand, is precisely, I think, the other element of their calculation may well be that he's potentially more dangerous in the future. That exactly if you're afraid about bottom-up mass discontent because of social reforms, which obviously tends to lead to social problems, Udaltsov is more likely to be someone who actually can speak to that constituency. And also because he's shown himself to be rather more bare-knuckled in his approach and in his willingness to basically take on the authorities. Because if we compare Udaltsov to Navalny, it's hard to see that Navalny necessarily has what it takes to push protests to the point of civic unrest. It may well be that, in fact, he would back away if it came to that situation. On the other hand, they know that Udaltsov is a street fighter at heart. And therefore, there may well be that calculation that he potentially is more dangerous and therefore is worth dealing with now.
Now, it's interesting you mentioned Navalny because there were rumors throughout the week that Navalny was going to get arrested today. I didn't take them terribly seriously because with this blowing up, do they really want to deal with both of these at the same time? Or maybe they do. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, and if we're assuming that when we say arrested, we don't just mean the usual overnight cooling
issues
in
the
police cell or whatever.
If
we mean
deal.
A proper arrest, I think to actually have both Udaltsov and Navalny targeted at once is not impossible, but what it would say is that we now are in a situation where Russia is heading for a general crackdown. I hesitate to use the word purge, but that the Bastrykinshchina was indeed beginning, that there was going to be some sort of fairly dramatic and comprehensive crackdown on the opposition. But again, for that to happen, that's certainly not something that Bastrykin can push himself. If that's going to happen, it's going to have to come down from the very top. It's going to have to be Putin. And it's going to be part of a fairly comprehensive crackdown. And I'm not quite sure that we're there yet. I'm not sure that Putin is convinced enough, willing enough, has the political will. You've got to remember, actually, for all his macho theatricals, Putin is very risk-averse. He's a conservative politician. He's happy to strike when he thinks that his victory is pretty much assured. And I think that is really the dilemma for him. At the moment, he doesn't know which is the safest and most reliable option, and that's why he's holding back.
Well, I thought the operative word in what you just said is we're not there yet. Do you think we could be headed there? I know you've partially answered that now, but how high is the likelihood, do you think, that we could head in that direction?
It all depends, I would suggest, on quite how mass politics emerges. In the long term, you never know. The opposition might well get their act together and start sort of building themselves up a viable political structure, which means that in 2 years, 3 years, 5 years' time, they'll be in a position to mount a constitutional challenge to the Kremlin. That's a long-term threat. And that's a relatively civilized one. I think that, again, if we want to draw the parallels, you know, it depends on whether or not Putin's Russia is going to face its 1990. That year when a combination of political paralysis at the top and pressure from below means that the state becomes really challenged by the overall society.
So we're not there yet, for sure, and on either count then. And that's a good note to stop on for now. In a few moments, we will shift gears and talk about a new law on treason and a new Kremlin initiative to promote patriotic values in the youth that give us more clues about where Putin is trying to take Russia. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor Mark Galeotti, author and editor of numerous books on Russia, as well as the must-read blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. That was Vladimir Putin playing on the piano the theme from Shield and Sword, a popular 1968 Soviet film about a spy in Nazi Germany. Espionage was very much in the news this week as the State Duma moved to redefine treason. The Duma passed a bill dramatically broadening treason's definition to include giving any assistance, intentional or unintentional, to anybody seeking to harm Russia's security. So broad and open to interpretation is the wording that rights activists say it could be used to indiscriminately prosecute the otherwise legal activities of business people, journalists, NGOs, or anybody who has contact with foreigners. The new legislation must still go through the formalities of passing the Federation Council and being signed by Putin to become law. Meanwhile, Putin announced last weekend the creation of a new agency, the Directorate of Social Projects, that will promote, quote, the patriotic upbringing, unquote, of young Russians. Mark, needless to say, this all sounds eerily familiar. Let's start with the patriotic upbringing business. It's long been known that Putin is an advisor of former Soviet leader and KGB chief Yuri Andropov. But this thing reminds me of some other Soviet leader. It reminds me of the campaign by Andropov's geriatric successor, Konstantin Chernenko, to improve the upbringing of Soviet children. This is basically the one initiative that came out of his very brief rule. Taken together, what do these two developments point to, in your opinion?
Well, I think they speak to several things. I mean, one is Putin's sort of loamy and visceral nostalgia for a Soviet Union that never really was, but that he would have loved it to have been. But two is, it's interesting that I think for Putin, who is, I mean, he's an effective politician when he has to be, but also I think he is in his own eyes, a moral figure. I think his view almost is that actually many of the problems that are facing the system at the moment are moral problems. Now, you and I might think moral problems mean
we may agree with Putin.
But I think from Putin's point of view, exactly, it's not that. It's not actually that officials have their snouts in the trough and so forth. For him, the moral issue is precisely that ordinary Russians have forgotten what a wonderful thing it is to be a Russian, and need to be reminded. And that, you know, the particular kind of Russian that he has in mind is not a free-thinking citizen of the world, but definitely a sort of good patriotic Russian. We saw this with the often infamous youth camps of the pro-Putin youth movement, where, you know, it proved to be fairly sort of pointless. But again, I think this is the thing, that Putin, first and foremost, does not want to get involved in the nuts and bolts. I mean, the same way as his view of government is that essentially it should be a smoothly working machine that does what he tells it to. He doesn't want to have to plan and map out how each cog interacts with another. He expects to simply to be able to sort of give broad instructions from the top and have minions to deal with that. Well, so too, his view of society is that it should be full of people happy to be told what to do and happy to follow in his tracks. And I think there's almost a certain bewilderment on his part that ordinary Russians aren't doing so. And therefore the hope is that you can sort of inform them this way. It's a bizarre and frankly deeply stupid strategy, but nonetheless I think it tells us quite a bit about what's going on inside Putin's little black box.
Well, another thing that struck me along these lines, you mentioned the pro-Putin youth camps, which in their time and for their time, according to the logic of the authorities at that time, they were actually fairly effective. I mean, this was a Surkov project, right? Now, Surkov himself decided that this kind of politics has basically outlived its usefulness and was actually in his time during the Medvedev presidency lobbying to move on to something different, a more managed form of pluralism. But now a more crude version of Surkovism is of the 2007 variety is being revived in 2012. Is this kind of, you know, 5 years behind the times is still behind the times. Is this a little behind the times? Hasn't Russian society moved on?
Russian society certainly has. I mean, I think I probably slightly question whether they were at all effective in their time, but we'll put that to one side. But yeah, I mean, as soon as you move something into being a directorate, you know that it's in trouble. And in some ways, I think this speaks to a dichotomy that I think particularly Kirill brought up in a previous podcast, that in a way we've seen the shift from the artist to the bureaucrat in terms of methods of trying to manage Russian society and Russian politics. This is a classic bureaucratization. You know, if you have a problem, what better to do than create a directorate and no doubt have a five-year plan for fixing it? We know exactly it's suddenly going to become about metrics, about some sort of one-size-fits-all method. But I think this is it. That's all that Putin's got now. Putin has two basic tools. He's got a bureaucratic machine, and he's got the control of the economy that the state still maintains. Now, the economic tool just isn't useful in this particular situation, so all he's really got is a state structure. If we're going to play parallels, and it's worth noting that we don't want to do Chernenko a disservice. He also had the attempt to try and win the Afghan war militarily, to his credit. So not one, but two massive failures. But in some ways, it almost reminds me actually of Gorbachev's anti-alcohol campaign, that when initially envisaged, it was meant to be both carrots and sticks, that yes, there will be attempts to crack down on availability of alcohol, but then there would also be a massive positive social dimension, opening up juice bars and milk bars for young people and education programs and all these kinds of things. But once it had been fed through this clunking, grinding political machine that was the Communist Party, all the positive stuff had been stripped out, right. And all that was left was just basically kind of coercion and plans and so forth. And it obviously had a disastrously negative effect. Well, it almost strikes me as reminiscent of that. If the problem is that Russians aren't happy, let's have a directorate for making them happy, and somehow you think that'll solve it. It also speaks, therefore, to Putin's essentially his isolation from society. He's moved further and further into this bubble. And I really think he doesn't understand Russians. And therefore, his view is not trying to understand Russians. It's trying to get Russians to think more the way he wants them to think.
Well, along those lines, the think tank affiliated with former finance minister Alexei Kudrin released a report this week showing that Putin's popularity is down to 44%. It's the lowest point of his presidency. But the more interesting thing, and I put this on the blog yesterday as well, the more interesting thing there was when respondents to the survey were asked to compare the authorities to an animal, they all named, 88% of them named a beast of prey. So this is how Russians, if you believe this survey, are looking at their leaders right now, which goes back to this whole thing, as you put, Putin is in a bubble. Another thing I wanted to address in addition to the treason law, which we haven't discussed yet, but let's talk about it in this context. Kirill often on the podcast says these authorities have no strategy. It's all about tactics. It's all reactive. I'm not so sure about that. This is one of the areas where he and I disagree. And I was wondering, taking this treason law together with this directorate of public projects together and going back up to the Udaltsov case and the apparent escalation against the opposition, do you see a strategy beginning to kind of come into focus now?
Let me sort of break that down in two ways first. Strategy doesn't necessarily mean, or rather, a lack of strategy doesn't necessarily mean that everything is purely random. Obviously, things connect and things link together. And yes, there is clearly a growing shift towards repression, a growing shift towards trying to mold, but above all, intimidate society. And I think, again, they're basically getting the machinery ready, not so much for the current political situation, but the political situation that might emerge if we begin to see serious social protest. So a lot of it is, I think, building the machines. But secondly, we have to think, whose strategy? Clearly, there are people within the government system who have a strategy. And it's people like Bastrykin, and also, I think someone who's worth sort of throwing into the mix that hasn't really been considered because it's sort of more kind of the territory of kind of wonkish types like myself, but Timur Valiulin, who is the relatively recently appointed head of the Interior Ministry's Anti-Extremism Directorate, who previously was in charge of Moscow's E-Center, which again is the anti-extremism element. And I mean, he definitely is on that kind of repressive line of things. There are other figures one can point to as well, who form a substantial block within the government who do have a strategy, and their strategy is much more, we need to bring pressure to bear and we will grind out the opposition. In the absence of any alternative strategies, then in a way, by default, that becomes government policy. But I think it will be a mistake to try and suggest that there's some kind of single comprehensive strategy that everyone has signed up for. To be honest, if this starts to go badly, I wouldn't be surprised if Putin has no problem in ditching it, or if someone else comes up with a better idea. So, yes, there is a strategy, but limitations.
Well, this leads into the last issue I wanted to discuss before we wrap up. And you very succinctly there pointed out that this is a part of the government, has a very clear strategy. This is becoming government policy now because there isn't an alternative, right? Now, if I'm from my reading of the Russian press and reading between the lines of the Russian press and everything, there is this Cold War going on within the elite right now between this side of the elite that you just described and the other side, your Surkovs, your Kudrins, the some say Medvedev fits into this side. I'm not quite sure myself yet. And they wanted to move into this more managed pluralism type of arrangement. And what they're doing now is they're just sitting back because they're so confident that this is going to fail. They're just waiting for it to fail. Is that enough? Is this just going to fail of its own volition? And if not, what has to happen to stop this machine, if anything?
Well, I mean, repression in the absence of any positive way of actually co-opting society fails in the longer term. And if the best that the repressive strategists have got is things like this Directorate of Social Projects, and sort of campaigns for patriotism and the like, then they really haven't got anything to try and sort of bring society on board. Now, in the good old days, in Putin 1.0, there was money. Essentially, there was a dynamic economic sort of resurgence after the miseries of the 1990s, and therefore that was what basically kept most Russians happy with the status quo. There might be all kinds of details that they weren't happy with, but basically it was a damn sight better than what had come before, and life was on the whole getting better, and seemed as if it would be even better next week and next year. It's a lot harder for Russians to believe that. So, I mean, I think that this isn't going to last. I mean, in the very long term, I'm extraordinarily optimistic for Russia. I think it is going through a very painful two steps forward, one and a half steps back transition, but it is moving towards freer, more open, democratic and liberal principles.
But not institutions.
Well, principles lead to institutions. It comes. I mean, again, from the lofty position of the historian or whatever, thinking in terms generational terms, it will come. But the point is, what concerns me, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that the Surkovs and Kudrins of this world are just sitting back, knowing it's going to fail, and also being aware that they have very little traction on what's going on in the Kremlin at the moment. But the point is that without any kind of credible alternative, and at present, the opposition does not represent a credible alternative. It's a bunch of people who don't like the status quo and are happy to say so, but they haven't really got anything beyond that. Actually, all you get is anger, despair, and despondency when things go badly. You can have as many Amon as you want. You can buy the biggest water cannon in the world, and indeed Russia has the biggest water cannon in the world. There are some things that don't change. But the point is, if there's nothing sort of to hold Russians to the state, repression is not going to do the trick. I mean, in this respect, Bastrykin and co. are wrong. Mm. But the point is, if there's no one else coming up with a better answer, then the wrong answer is the one that's going to be adopted. Right. So this is my concern. I think we do have a vacuum, in terms of political options at the moment.
And you don't see anything that could potentially fill that vacuum?
Potentially, there's lots of things that could fill the vacuum. The opposition could get serious. Either they manage to find some kind of cohering principles that can bring together, a Navalny, a Gudkov, and a Nudaltsov.
The coordinating council? I mean, I know it's much derided, but it is an attempt to do something like this.
It's a council. It's basically a standing meeting. Mm. Now, obviously we all
or a
know
shadow parliament.
Or you need a shadow parliament. But even then, I mean, a parliament doesn't actually create a structure. I mean, parliaments have to have some kind of parties or other notions. Now, again, it could well be that they find a way of living together. I mean, you made this point that it could well be that what actually unites them is a sense of the ground rules. Mm-hmm. A sense, this is the politics that we want. We'll disagree on any of the details and on budget allocations and all that kind of nuts and bolts, but at least we can agree on principles. Maybe they can do that. So that's potential number one. Potential number two is that the council never comes to anything and that they go their separate ways and we begin to see real parties with real policies and ideologies emerging to challenge. Potential number three is there's some other force that we haven't seen. Somewhere there is the Russian Lech Wałęsa currently working in a steel mill somewhere around whom some kind of political faction is going to sort of cohere magically the way it did in Poland. In the way it does when there's a lot of latent dissatisfaction there. But, I mean, it's worth noting that although the Kudrin polls show Putin at a record low, 44% is not that bad a low, but we should also mention there's also the Levada polls that actually suggest the support for Putin. So we're not quite sure of the exact data. But I'm saying, I mean, what we're talking about is a vast amount of potentialities. And that's a very, very unstable situation. And in a way, the problem is that the only people with a strategy at the moment, the hardliners, their strategy is, look, let's build up all our resources. Let's make sure that we have the cops and the water cannon. Let's make sure we have the treason laws and everything else. So when it comes to it, we can deal with it heavily.
I guess that's a good note to wrap up today. And fortunately, that's all we have time for. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the line with me has been Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for the great discussion, Mark.
Always a pleasure.
And I'd also like to thank our excellent producer, Tanya Koncheva. And I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank another unsung member of the Power Vertical podcast team, Pavel Buturin of the indispensable Twitter feed Russia Police Watch, who always gives me good ideas and advice and who helps Tanya put together all the cool audio bits we use in this podcast. Any serious Russia watcher should follow Pavel's Twitter feed at Rus Police Watch. I would also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can also read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week when Mark will be back, and we'll both be joined by Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies. Kirill will be back in 2 weeks, hopefully with a lot of good stories from Siberia. And now, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.